Track 3.
The last turn in the channel came up ahead, and again Dancer's hull touched coral. The sound of it seemed to tear into my very soul. And then at last we burst out into the deep pool in the back of the main reef, a circular arena of deep water 300 yards across, fenced in by coral walls, and open only through the gunfire break to the wild surf of the Indian Ocean. Chubby appeared at my shoulder once more. "Tight as a mouse's ear, Harry. Not taken on a drop." Silently, I applauded my darling. And now, for the first time, we were in full view of the gun crew, half a mile away across the reef, and my turn into the pool presented Dancer to them broadside. As though they sensed that this was their last chance, they poured shot after shot at us. It fell about us in great leaping spouts, too close to allow me any latitude of decision. I swung Dancer again, aimed her at the narrow break, and let her race for the gap in Gunfire Reef. I committed her, and when we'd passed the point of no return, I felt my belly cramp up with horror as I looked ahead through the gap to the open sea. It seemed as though the whole ocean was up rearing ahead of me, gathering itself to hurl itself down upon the frail little vessel like some rampaging monster. "Chubby," I called out hollowly, "will you look at that?" "Harry," he whispered, "this is a good time to pray." And Dancer ran out bravely to meet this freak Goliath of the sea. It came up, humping monstrous shoulders as it charged. Higher and higher still it rose, a glassy green wall, and I could hear it rustling, like wildfire in dry grass. Another shot passed close overhead, but I hardly noticed it, as Dancer threw up her head and began to climb that mountainous wave. It was turning pale green along the crest high above, beginning to curl, and Dancer went up as though she were on an elevator. The deck canted steeply, and we clung helplessly to the rail. "She's going over backwards," Chubby shouted, as she began to stand on her tail. "She's turtling, man." "Go through her," I called to Dancer. "Cut through the green." And as though she heard me, she lunged with her sharp prow into the curl of the wave, an instant before it could fall upon us and crush the hull. It came aboard us in a roaring green horror. Solid sheets of it swept Dancer from bows to stern, 6 feet deep, and she lurched as though to a mortal blow. And then, suddenly, we burst out through the back of the wave, and below us was a gaping valley, a yawning abyss, into which Dancer hurled herself, falling free, a gut-swooping drop down into the trough. We hit with a sickening crash that seemed to stun her, and which threw Chubby and me to the deck. But as I dragged myself up again, Dancer shook herself free of the tons of water that had come aboard, and she ran on to meet the next wave. This one was smaller, and Dancer beat the curl and porpoised over her. "That's my darling," I shouted to her, and she picked up speed, taking the third wave like a steeplechaser. Somewhere close, another 3-pound shell cracked the sky. But then we were out and running for the long horizon of the ocean, and I never heard another shot. The guard who had passed out in the cockpit from an excess of Scotch whisky must have been washed overboard by the giant wave, for we never saw him again. The other three we left on a small island 30 miles north of St. Mary's, where I knew there was water in a brackish well, and which would certainly be visited by fishermen from the mainland. They'd sobered by that time, and were all inflicted with nasty hangovers. They made 3 forlorn figures on the beach as we ran southwards into the dusk. It was dark when we crept into Grand Harbour. I picked up moorings, not tying up to the wharf at Admiralty, I did not want Dancer's glaring injuries to become a subject of speculation around the island. Chubby and Angelo went ashore in the dinghy, but I was too exhausted to make the effort, and dinnerless, I collapsed across the double bunk in the master cabin and slept without moving until Judith woke me after 9 in the morning. Angelo had sent her down with a dinner pail of fish cakes and bacon. Chubby and Angelo gone up to Mrs. Eddy's to buy some stores they need to repair the boat, she told me. They'll be down soon now. I wolfed the breakfast and went to shave and shower. When I returned, she was still there, sitting on the edge of the bunk. She clearly had something to discuss. She brushed away my clumsy efforts at dressing my wound and had me sit while she worked on it. Mr. Harry, you aren't going to get my Angelo killed or jailed, are you? She demanded. If you go on like this, I'm going to make him come ashore. That's great, Judy, I laughed at her concern. Why don't you send him across to Rowano for 3 years while you sit here?
That's not kind, Mr. Harry.
Life is not very kind, Judith, I told her more gently. Angelo and I are both doing the best we can, just to keep my boat afloat. And I've got to take a few chances, and some with Angelo. He told me that he saved enough to buy you a nice little house up near the church. He got the money by running with me. She was silent while she finished the dressing, and when she would have turned to go, I took her hand and drew her back. She wouldn't look at me until I took her chin and lifted her face. She was a lovely child, with great smoky eyes and a smoothly silken skin. Don't fuss yourself, Judith. Angelo is like a kid brother to me. I'll look after him. She studied my face for a long moment. You really mean that, don't you? She asked. I really do.
I believe you, she said at last, and she smiled.
Her teeth were very white against the golden amber skin.
I trust you.
Women are always saying that to me. I trust you. So much for feminine intuition. You name one of your kids for me, here.
The first one, Mr. Harry.
Her smile blazed and her dark eyes flashed.
And that's a promise.
They do say that when you fall from a horse, you should immediately ride him again, so as not to lose your nerve, Mr. Harry. Fred Coker sat at his desk in the travel agency, behind him a poster of a beefeater and Big Ben. England swings, it said. We had just discussed at great length our mutual concern at Inspector Peter Daly's perfidious conduct, though I suspected that Fred Coker's concern was considerably less than mine. He had collected his commission in advance, and nobody had put his head in a noose, nor had they almost wrecked his boat. We were now discussing the subject of whether or not our business arrangement should continue. They also say, Mr. Coker, that a man with his buttocks hanging out of the holes in his trousers should not be too fussy, I said. And Coker's spectacles glittered with satisfaction. He nodded his head.
And that, Mr. Harry, is probably the wiser of the two sayings, he agreed.
I'll take anything. Body, box, or sticks. Just one thing. The cost of dying has gone up to $10,000 a run, and all in advance.
Even at that price, we shall find work for you, he promised.
And I realized I'd been working cheaply before. Soon, I insisted.
Very soon, he agreed. You are fortunate. I do not think that Inspector Daly will be returning to St. Mary's now. You will save the commission, usually payable there.
Well, he owes me that at least, I agreed. I made 3 night runs in the next 6 weeks. 2 body carries and a box job, all below the river into Portuguese waters. The bodies were both singles, silent black men dressed in jungle fatigues, and I took them far south, deep penetrations. They waded ashore on remote beaches, and I wondered briefly upon what unholy missions they travelled, how much pain and death would arise from those secret landings. The box job involved 18 long wooden crates with Chinese markings. We picked up from a submarine out in the channel and dropped off in a river mouth, unloading into pairs of dugout canoes lashed together for stability. We spoke to no one and nobody challenged us. They were milk runs, and I cleared $18,000, enough to carry me and my crew through the off-season in the style to which we were accustomed. More important, the intervals of quiet and rest were sufficient to heal my wounds and give me back my strength. At first, I lay for hours in the hammock under the palms, reading or sleeping. Then, as it came back to me, I swam and fished and sunbaked, went for oysters and crayfish, until I was hard and lean and sunburned again. The wound healed into a thickened and irregular cicatrice, tribute to McNab's surgical skills. It curled around my chest and onto my back like an angry purple dragon. In one thing he had been correct. The massive damage to my upper left arm left it stiff and weakened. I couldn't lift my elbow above shoulder level, and I lost my title in Indian wrestling to Chubby in the bar of the Lord Nelson. However, I hoped that swimming and regular exercise might strengthen it. As my strength returned, so did my curiosity and sense of adventure. I began dreaming about the canvas-wrapped package off Big Gull Island. In one dream I swam down and opened the package. It contained a tiny feminine figure the size of a Dresden doll, a golden mermaid with Sister May's lovely face and a truly startling bosom. The tail was the graceful sickle shape of a marlin's. The little mermaid smiled shyly and held out her hand to me. On her palm lay a shiny silver shilling. Sex, money, and billfish, I thought when I woke. Good old uncomplicated Harry. Real Freud food. I knew then that pretty soon I would be going for Big Gull Island. It was very late in the season before I could prevail on Fred Coker to arrange a straight fishing charter for me, and it turned sour as cheap wine. The party consisted of two overweight, flabby German industrialists with fat, bejeweled wives. I worked hard for them and put both men into fish. The first was a good black marlin, but the party screwed down on his star drag, freezing the reel while the fish was still green and crazy to run. It lifted the German's huge backside out of his seat, and before I could release the star drag for him, it had my $300 rod down on the gunwale. The fiberglass rod snapped like a matchstick. The other member of the party, after losing two decent fish, panted and sweated 3 hours over a baby blue marlin. When he finally brought it to the gaff, I could hardly bring myself to put the steel in, and I was too ashamed to hang it on Admiralty. We took the photographs on board Dancer, and I smuggled it ashore wrapped in a tarpaulin. Like Fred Coker, I also have a reputation to preserve. The German industrialist, however, was so delighted by his prize that he slipped an extra $500 into my avaricious little paw. I told him it was a truly magnificent fish, which was a $1,000 lie. I always give good value. Then the wind backed into the south, the temperature of the water in the channel dropped 4 degrees, and the fish were gone. For 10 days we hunted far north, but it was over. Another season was past. We stripped and cleaned all the billfish equipment and laid it away in thick yellow grease. I pulled Dancer up onto the slip at the fueling basin, and we went over her hull, cleaning it down, reworking the temporary patches I'd put on the injuries she'd received at Gunfire Reef. Then we painted her until she glistened, sleek and lovely, before we refloated her and took her out to moorings. There we worked lackadaisically on her upper works, stripping varnish, sandpapering, re-varnishing, checking out the electricity system, resoldering a connection here and replacing wiring there. I was in no hurry. It would be 3 weeks before my next charter arrived, an expedition of marine biologists from a Canadian university. In the meantime, the days were cooler, and I was feeling the old glow of good health and bodily well-being again. I dined at Government House, sometimes as often as once a week. And each time I had to tell the full story of the shootout with Guthrie and Matteson. President Biddle knew the story by heart and corrected me if I made a single mistake. It always ended with the president crying excitedly, "Show them your scar, Mr. Harry." And I had to open the starched front of my dress shirt at the dinner table. They were good, lazy days. The island life drifted placidly by. Peter Daly never returned to St. Mary's. And at the end of 6 weeks, Wally Andrews was promoted to acting inspector and commanding officer of the police force. One of his first acts was to return to me my FN carbine. This quiet time was spiced by the secret tingle of anticipation which I felt. I knew that one day soon I was going back to Big Gull Island, and the piece of unfinished business that lay there in the shallow, limpid waters, and I teased myself with the knowledge. Then, one Friday evening, I was rounding out the week with my crew in the bar of the Lord Nelson. Judith was with us, having replaced the flock that had previously gathered round Angelo on Friday nights. She was good for him. He no longer drank to the morbid stage. Chubby and I had just begun the first duet of the evening and were keeping within a few beats of each other when Marion slipped into the seat beside me. I put one arm around her shoulders and held my tankard to her lips while she drank thirstily. But the distraction caused me to forge even further ahead of Chubby in the song. Marion worked on the switchboard at the Hilton Hotel. She was a pretty little thing, with a sexy pug face and long, straight black hair. It was she whom Mike Guthrie had used for a punch bag so long ago. When Chubby and I straggled to the end of the chorus, Marion told me, "There is a lady asking for you, Mr. Harry." "What lady?" "At the hotel. One of the guests. She came in on this morning's plane. She knew your name and everything. She wants to see you. I told her I would see you tonight and give you the message." "What is she like?" I asked Marion with interest. "She is beautiful, Mr. Harry, and such a lady too." "Sounds like my type." I agreed and ordered a pint for Marion. "Aren't you going to see her now? With you beside me, Marion? All the beautiful ladies of the world can wait until tomorrow." "Oh, Mr. Harry, you are a real devil man," she giggled, and snuggled a little closer. "Harry," said Chubby on my other side, "I'm going to tell you now what I never told you before." And he took a long swallow from his tankard, and then went on with sentimental tears swimming in his eyes. "Harry, I love you, man. I love you better than my own brother." I went up to the Hilton a few minutes before midday. Marion came through from her cubicle behind the reception desk. She still had her earphones around her neck. "She's waiting for you on the terrace." And she pointed across the vast reception area with an ersatz Hawaiian decor. "The blonde lady in the yellow bikini." She was reading a magazine lying on her belly on one of the reclining sun couches, and she had her back to me. So my first impression was of masses of blonde hair, thick and shiny, teased up like the mane of a lion, and then falling in a slick golden cascade. She heard my footsteps on the paving. She glanced around, pushed her sunglasses up on top of her head. Then she stood up to face me, and I realized that she was tiny, seeming to reach not much higher than my chest. The bikini also was tiny, and showed a flat, smooth belly with a deep navel, firm shoulders, lightly tanned, small breasts, and a trim waist. Her legs had lovely lines, and her neat little feet were thrust into open sandals, the nails painted clear red to match her long fingernails. Her hands, as she pushed at her hair, were small and shapely. She wore heavy makeup, but wore it with rare skill, so that her skin had a soft, pearly luster, and colour glowed subtly on her cheeks and lips. Her eyes had long, dark, artificial lashes, and the eyelids were touched with colour and line to give them an exotic, oriental cast. "Duck, Harry!" Something deep inside me shouted a warning, and I almost obeyed. I knew this type well. There had been others like her, small and purringly feline. I had scars to prove it, scars both physical and spiritual. However, one thing nobody can say about old Harry is that he runs for cover when the knickers are down. Courageously, I stepped forward, crinkling my eyes and twisting my mouth into the naughty small boy grin that usually dynamites them. "Hello," I said. "I'm Harry Fletcher." She looked at me, starting at my feet and going up 6'4" to the top, where her gaze lingered speculatively, and she pouted her lower lip. "Hello," she answered. Her voice was husky, breathless sounding, and carefully rehearsed. "I'm Sherry North. Jimmy North's sister." We were on the veranda of the shack in the evening. It was cool, and the sunset was a spectacular display of pyrotechnics that flamed and faded above the palms. She was drinking a Pimm's Number 1, filled with fruit and ice, one of my seduction specials, and she wore a caftan of light floating stuff through which her body showed in shadowy outline as she stood against the rail, backlit by the sunset. I couldn't be certain as to whether or not she wore anything beneath the caftan. This and the tinkle of ice in her glass distracted me from the letter I was reading. She had showed it to me as part of her credentials. It was a letter from Jimmy North, written a few days before his death. I recognized the handwriting, and the turn of phrase was typical of that bright and eager lad. As I read on, I forgot the sister's presence in the memory of the past. It was a long, bubbling letter, written as though to a loving friend, with veiled references to the mission and its successful outcome, the promise of a future in which there would be wealth and laughter, and all good things. I felt a pang of regret and personal loss for the boy in his lonely sea grave, for the lost dreams that drifted with him like rotting seaweed. And then suddenly my own name leapt from that page at me. "You can't help liking him, Sherry. He's big and tough-looking, all scarred and beat up like an old tomcat that's been out alley-fighting every night. But under it, I swear, he's really a softy. He seems to have taken a shine to me. Even gives me fatherly advice." There was more in the same vein that embarrassed me so that my throat closed up and I took a swallow of whiskey, which made my eyes water and the words swim, while I finished the letter and refolded it. I handed it to Sherry and walked away to the end of the veranda. I stood there for a while, looking out over the bay. The sun slid below the horizon, and suddenly it was dark and chill. I went back and lit the lamp, setting it up high so that the glare didn't fall in our eyes. She watched me in silence until I'd poured another scotch and settled in my cane-backed chair. "Okay," I said. "You're Jimmy's sister. You've come to St. Mary's to see me."
"Why?" "You liked him, didn't you?"
she asked, as she left the rail and came to sit beside me. "I like a lot of people. It's a weakness of mine."
"Did he die? I mean, was it like they said in the newspapers?"
"Yes," I said, "it was like that."
"Did he ever tell you what they were doing out here?"
I shook my head.
"No. They were very cagey,
and I don't ask questions." She was silent then, dipping long, tapered fingers into her glass to pick out a slice of pineapple, nibbling at the fruit with small white teeth, dabbing at her lips with a pink pointed tongue like that of a cat.
"Because Jimmy liked and trusted you, and because I think you know more than you've told anyone, and also because I need your help, I'm going to tell you a story. All right?"
"I love stories," I said.
"Have you heard of the pogo stick?" she asked.
"Oh, sure. It's a child's toy."
"It is also the code name for an American naval experimental vertical take-off all-weather strike aircraft."
"Oh, yes. Yes, of course, I remember. I saw an article in Time magazine, Questions in the Senate. Forget the details.
There was opposition to the $50 million development allocation."
"Yes, I remember that."
"2 years ago, on the 16th of August, to be precise, a prototype pogo stick took off from Rowano Air Force Base in the Indian Ocean. It was armed with 4 air-to-surface killer whale missiles, each of them equipped with tactical nuclear warheads."
"That must have been a fairly lethal package."
She nodded. "The killer whale is designed as an entirely new concept in missiles. It is an anti-submarine device which will seek and track surfaced or submerged naval craft. It can kill an aircraft carrier, or it can change its element, air for water, and go down 1,000 fathoms to destroy enemy submarines."
"Wow," I said, and took a little more whiskey. We were talking heady stuff now.
"Do you recall the 16th of August that year? Were you here?"
"Yes, I was here, but, well, it's a long time ago. Refresh my memory."
"Cyclone Cynthia," she said.
"Good God, of course." "It had come roaring across the island, winds of 150 miles an hour, taking away the roof of the shack and almost swamping Dancer at her moorings in Grand Harbour. These cyclones were not uncommon in this area. The pogo stick took off from Rowano a few minutes before the typhoon struck. 12 minutes later, the pilot ejected, and the aircraft went into the sea with her 4 nuclear missiles and her flight recorder still aboard. Rowano radar was blanked out by the typhoon. They went tracking. It was starting to make some sort of sense at last."
"How does Jimmy fit into this?"
She made an impatient gesture.
"Wait," she said, and then went on. "Do you have any idea what the value of that cargo might be in the open market?"
"I should imagine you could write your own check, give or take a couple of million dollars." And old Bad Harry came to attention. He'd been getting exercise lately, and growing stronger. Sherry nodded. The test pilot of the pogo stick was a commander in the United States Navy named William Bryce. The aircraft developed a fault at 50,000 feet just before he came out through the top of the weather. He fought her all the way down. He was a conscientious officer. But at 500 feet, he knew he wasn't going to make it. He ejected and watched the aircraft go in. She was speaking carefully, and her choice of words was odd, too technical for a woman. She had learnt all this, and I was certain she had learnt it from Jimmy or from somebody else. Listen and learn, Harry, I told myself. Billy Bryce was 3 days on a rubber raft on the ocean in a typhoon before the rescue helicopter from Roano found him. He had time to do some thinking. One of the things he thought about was the value of that cargo, and he compared it to the salary of a commander. His evidence at the Court of Inquiry omitted the fact that Pogo Stick had gone down within sight of land, and that Bryce had been able to take a fix on a recognizable land feature before he was blown out to sea by the typhoon. I couldn't see any weakness in her story. Looked all right, and very interesting. The Court of Inquiry gave a verdict of pilot error, and Bryce resigned his commission. His career was destroyed by that verdict. He decided to earn his own retirement annuity and also to clear his reputation. He was going to force the United States Navy to buy back its killer whale missiles and to accept the evidence of the flight recorder. I was going to ask a question, but again Sherry stopped me with a gesture. She didn't want her recital interrupted. Jimmy had done some work for the U.S. Navy, a hull inspection of one of their carriers, and he'd met Bryce at that time. They'd become friends, and so Billy Bryce naturally came to Jimmy. Between them, they hadn't sufficient capital for the expedition they needed to mount, so they planned to find financial backers. It isn't the kind of thing that you can advertise in the Times, and they were working on it when Billy Bryce was killed in his Thunderbird on the M4 near the Heathrow turnoff. There seems to me to be some sort of curse on the thing, I said. Are you superstitious, Harry? She asked, looking at me through those slanted tiger eyes. I don't knock it, I admitted, and she nodded, seeming to file the information away before she went on. After Billy was dead, Jimmy went on with the project. He found backers. He wouldn't tell me who, but I guessed they were unsavory. He came out here with them and, well, you know the rest. I know the rest, I agreed, and instinctively massaged the thickened scar tissue through the silk of my shirt. Except, of course, the sight of the crash. We stared at each other. Did he tell you? I asked. And she shook her head. Oh, well, it was an interesting story, and I grinned at her. Pity we can't check the truth of it. She stood up abruptly and went to the veranda rail. She hugged her arms, and she was so angry that if she'd had a tail, she would have switched it like a lioness. I waited for her to recover, and the moment came when she shrugged her shoulders and turned back to me. Her smile was light. Oh, well, that's that. I thought I was entitled to some of the rewards. Jimmy was my brother, and I came a long way to find you because he liked and trusted you. I thought we could work together. But I guess if you want it all, there's not much I can do about it. She shook out her hair, and it rippled and shone in the lamplight. I stood up. I'll take you home now, I said, and touched her arm. She reached up with both arms, and her fingers locked in the thick, curly hair at the back of my neck. It's a long way home, she whispered, and pulled my head down, standing on her tiptoes. Her lips were very soft and moist, and her tongue was thrusting and restless. After a while she drew back and smiled up at me, her eyes unfocused and her breath short and fast. Perhaps it wasn't a wasted journey, after all. I picked her up, and she was light as a child, hugging my neck, pressing her cheek to mine as I carried her into the shack. I learnt long ago to eat hearty whenever there was food, because you never know when the famine is going to hit. Even the soft light of dawn was cruel to her as she lay sprawled in sleep beneath the mosquito net on the big double bed. Her makeup had smeared and caked, and she slept with her mouth open. The mane of blonde hair was a tangled bush, and it didn't match the triangle of thick, dark curls at the base of her belly. I felt repelled by her this morning, for I'd learnt during the night that Miss Sherry was a raving sadist. I slipped out of the bed and stood over her for a few moments, searching her sleeping face in vain for a resemblance to Jimmy North. I left her and, still naked, walked out of the shack and down to the beach. The tide was in, and I plunged into the cool, clear water and swam out to the entrance to the bay. I swam fast, driving hard in an Australian crawl, and the salt water stung the deep scratches in my back. It was one of my lucky mornings. Old friends were waiting for me beyond the reef. A school of big bottle-nosed porpoise, who came flashing to meet me, their tall fins cutting the dark surface as they steeplechased over the swells. They circled me, whistling and snorting, the blowholes in the tops of their heads gulping like tiny mouths, and their own huge mouths fixed in idiotic grins of pleasure. They teased me for 10 minutes before one of the big old bulls allowed me to get a grip on his dorsal fin and gave me a tow. It was a thrilling sleigh ride that had the water creaming wildly about my chest and head. He took me half a mile offshore before the force of water tore me from his back. It was a long swim back, with the bull dolphin circling me and giving me an occasional friendly prod in the backside, inviting me aboard for another ride. At the reef, they whistled farewell and slid gracefully away, and I was happy when I waded ashore. The arm ached a little, but it was the healthy ache of healing and growing strength. The bed was empty and the bathroom door was locked. She was probably shaving her armpits with my razor, I thought. I felt a flare of annoyance. An old dog like me doesn't like his routine disturbed. I used the gas jar to sluice off the salt, and my annoyance receded under the rush of hot water. And then, fresh, but unshaven and hungry as a python, I went through to the kitchen. I was frying gammon with pineapple and buttering thick cuts of toast when Sherry came into the kitchen. She was once more immaculate. She must have carried a complete cosmetic counter in the Gucci handbag, and her hair was dressed and lacquered into its mane and fall. Her smile was brilliant. "Good morning, lover," she said, and came to kiss me lingeringly. I was now well disposed towards the world and all its creatures. I no longer felt repelled by this glittering woman. The fine mood of the dolphins had returned, and my gaiety must have been infectious. We laughed a lot over the meal, and afterwards I took the coffee pot out onto the veranda. "When are we going to find the pogo stick?" she asked suddenly. And I poured another mug of strong black coffee without answering. Sherry North had evidently decided that a night of her company had made me her slave for life. Now, I may not be a connoisseur of women, but on the other hand, I have had some little experience. I mean, I'm not exactly a virgin. And I didn't rate Sherry North's charms as worth 4 killer whale missiles and the flight recorder of a secret strike aircraft. "Just as soon as you show me the way," I answered carefully. It is an old-fashioned feminine conceit that if a man pleasures them with skill and aplomb,
then he must be made to pay for it. I have long believed that it should be the other way round. She reached across and held my wrist. The tiger's eyes were suddenly big and soulful. "After last night," she whispered huskily, "I know that there is a lot ahead of us, Harry. You and I, together." I had lain awake for hours during the night and reached my decision. Whatever lay in the package was not an entire aircraft, but probably some small part of it, something that identified it clearly. It was almost certainly not either the flight recorder or one of the missiles. Jimmy North would not have had sufficient time to remove the recorder from the fuselage, even if he'd known where it was situated and had the proper tools. On the other hand, the package was the wrong shape and size for a missile. It was a squat, round object, not aerodynamically designed. It was almost certain some fairly innocuous object. If I took Sherry North with me to recover it, I would be playing only a minor card from my hand, although it would look like a major trump. I would be giving nothing away, not the site of the crash at Gunfire Reef, nor any of the valuable objects associated with it. On the other hand, I would be beating the tall grass for tigers. It would be very instructive to see exactly how Mademoiselle North reacted once she thought she knew the site of the crash. "Harry," she whispered again, "please." And she leaned closer. "You must believe me. I have never felt like this before. From the first moment I saw you, I just knew..." I roused myself from my calculations and leaned towards her, assuming an expression of simple-minded passion and lust. "Darling," I began. But my voice closed up, and I enfolded her in a bear hug, feeling her stiffen irritably as I smeared her lipstick and ruffled the meticulously dressed hairstyle. I could sense the effort it required for her to respond with equal passion. "Do you feel the same way?" she asked from the depth of my embrace, smothered against my chest. And for the fun of watching her play the role she'd assigned herself, I picked her up again and carried her through to the frowsy, rumpled bed. "I will show you how I feel for you," I muttered hoarsely. "Darling, darling," she protested desperately. Not now." "Why not?" "We have so much to do. There will be time later, all the time in the world." With a show of reluctance, I set her down. Although, truthfully, I was thankful, for I knew that on top of a huge breakfast of gammon and 3 cups of coffee, it would have given me heartburn. It was a few minutes after noon when I cleared Grand Harbour and swung away south and east. I'd told my crew to take a day ashore. I wouldn't be fishing. Chubby looked down at Sherry North, sprawled, bikini-clad on the cockpit deck, and scowled noncommittally. But Angelo rolled his eyes expressively and said, "Pleasure cruise?" with a certain inflection. "You got a filthy mind," I scolded him, and he laughed delightedly as though I'd paid him the nicest compliment, and the two of them walked away up the wharf. Dancer romped down the necklace of atolls and islands until a little after 3 o'clock I ran the deep water passage between Little Gull Island and Big Gull Island and rounded into the shallow, open water between the east shore of Big Gull and the blue water of the Mozambique. There was enough breeze to make the day pleasantly cool and to kick up a white, flecky chop off the surface. I manoeuvred carefully, squinting over at Big Gull as I put Dancer into position. When I hit the marks, I pushed a little upwind to allow for Dancer's fallback. Then I cut the engines and hurried down to the foredeck to drop the hook. Dancer came round and settled down like a well-behaved lady. "Is this the place?" Sherry had watched everything I did with her disconcerting feline stare. This is it. And I risked overplaying my part as the besotted lover by pointing out the marks to her. I lined up those two palms, the ones leaning over, do you see, with that single palm, right up on the skyline. Can you see it? She nodded silently, and again I caught that look, as though the information was being carefully filed and remembered. Now what do we do? She asked. Well, this is where Jimmy dived, I explained. When he came back on board, he was very excited. He spoke secretly with the others, Matteson and Guthrie, and they seemed to catch his excitement. Jimmy went down again with rope and a tarpaulin. He was down a long time. And when he came up again, it started. The shooting. Yes, she nodded eagerly. The reference to her brother's death seemed to leave her unmoved. We should go now, before someone else sees us here. Go? I asked, looking at her. I thought we were going to have a look. She recognized her mistake. We should organize it properly. Come back when we're prepared, when we've made arrangements to pick up and transport. Lover, I grinned. I didn't come all this way not to take at least one quick look. I don't think you should, Harry, she called after me. But already I was opening the engine room hatch. Let's come back another time, she persisted. But I went down the ladder to the rack which held the air bottles and took down a Draeger twinset. I fitted the breathing valve and tested the seal, sucking air out of the rubber mouthpiece. Glancing quickly up at the hatch, to make sure she was not watching me, I reached across and threw the concealed cutout switch on the electrical system. Now nobody could start Dancer's engines while I was overboard. I swung the diving ladder over the stern and then dressed in the cockpit. Short-sleeved, neoprene wetsuit and hood, weight belt, knife, Nemrod wraparound faceplate and fins. I slung the scuba set on my back and picked up a coil of light nylon rope and hooked it onto my belt. What happens if you don't come back? Sherry asked, showing apprehension for the first time. I mean, what happens to me? You'll pine to death, I told her, and went over the side. Not in a showy backflip, but a simple use of the steps, more in keeping with my age and dignity. The water was transparent as mountain air, and as I went head down, I could see every detail of the bottom 50 feet below. It was a coral landscape, lit with dappled light and wondrous colour. I drifted down to it, and the sculptured shapes of the coral were softened and blurred with sea growth and restless with the sparkling jewels of myriad tropical fish. There were deep gullies and standing towers of coral, fields of eelgrass between, and open stretches of blinding white coral sand. My marks had been remarkably accurate, considering the fact that I'd been only just conscious from blood loss. I had dropped the anchor almost directly on top of the canvas package. It lay on one of the open spaces of coral sand, looking like some horrible sea monster, green and squat, with the loose ropes floating about it like tentacles. I crouched beside it, and shoals of tiny fish, zebra-striped in black and gold, gathered around me in such numbers that I had to blow bubbles at them and shoo them off before I could get on with the job. I unclipped the nylon rope from my belt and lashed one end securely to the package with a series of half-hitches. Then I rose to the surface, slowly paying out the line. I surfaced 30 feet astern of Dancer, swam to the ladder, and clambered into the cockpit. I made the end of the line fast to the arm of the fighting chair. "What did you find?" Sherry demanded anxiously. "I don't know yet," I told her. I had resisted the temptation to open the package on the bottom. I hoped it might be worth the sacrifice to watch her expression as I opened the canvas. I stripped my diving gear and washed it off with fresh water before stowing it all carefully away. I wanted the tension to eat into her a little longer. "Oh, damn you, Harry! Let's get it up!" she burst out at last.
I remembered the package as being as heavy as all creation. But then my strength had been almost gone. Now I braced myself against the gunwale and began recovering line. It was heavy, but not impossibly so, and I coiled the wet line as it came in with the old tunny fisherman's wrist action. The green canvas broke the surface alongside, sodden and gushing water. I reached over and got a purchase on the knotted rope, and with a single heave I lifted it over the side, and it clunked weightily onto the deck of the cockpit, metal against wood. "Open it," ordered Sherry impatiently. "Right away, madam," I said, and drew the bait knife from the sheath on my belt. It was razor-sharp, and I cut the ropes with a single stroke for each. Sherry was leaning forward eagerly as I drew the stiff, wet folds of canvas aside, and I was watching her face. The greedy, anticipatory expression flared suddenly into triumph as she recognized the object. She recognized it before I did, and then instantly she dropped a curtain of uncertainty over her eyes and face. It was very nicely done. She was an actress of some skill. Had I not been watching carefully for it, I would have missed the quick play of emotion. I looked down at the humble object for which already so many men had been killed or mutilated, and I was torn with surprise and puzzlement and disappointment. It wasn't what I'd expected. Half of it was badly eaten away as though by a sandblasting machine. The bronze was raw and shiny and deeply etched. The upper half of it was intact, but tarnished heavily with a thick skin of greenish verdigris. But the lug for the shackle was intact, and the ornamentation was still clear through the corrosion, a heraldic crest, or part of it, and lettering in a flowery antique style. The lettering was fragmentary. Most of it had been etched away in an irregular flowing line, leaving the bright, worn metal. It was a ship's bell, cast in massive bronze. It must have weighed close to 100 pounds, with a domed and lugged top and a wide, flared mouth. Curiously, I rolled it over. The clapper had corroded solidly, and barnacle and other shellfish had encrusted the interior. I was intrigued by the pattern of wear and corrosion on the outside, until suddenly the solution occurred to me. I had seen other metal objects marked like this after long submersion. The bell had been half-bedded on the sandy bottom. The exposed portion had been subjected to the tidal rush of gunfire break, and the fine grains of coral sand had abrased away a quarter of an inch of the outer skin of the metal. However, the portion that had been buried was protected, and now I examined the remaining lettering more closely. VVN and L. There was an extended V, or a broken W, followed immediately by a perfect N, then a gap, and a whole L. But beyond that, the lettering had been obliterated again. The coat of arms worked into the metal on the opposite side of the barrel was an intricate design with two rampant beasts, probably lions, supporting a shield and a mailed head. It seemed vaguely familiar, and I wondered where I'd seen it before. I rocked back on my heels and looked at Sherry North. She was unable to meet my gaze. "Funny thing," I mused. "A jet aircraft with a bloody great brass bell hanging on its nose." I don't understand," she said. "No more do I." I stood up and went to get a cheroot from the saloon. I lit it and sat back in the fighting chair. "Okay, let's hear your theory."
"I don't know, Harry. Truly, I don't."
"Well, let's try some guesses," I suggested.
"I'll begin."
She turned away to the rail. "The jet aircraft turned into a pumpkin," I hazarded. "How about that one?" She turned back to me.
"Harry, I don't feel well. I think I'm going to be sick."
"So, what must I do?"
"Let's go back now," I was thinking of another dive. Look around a bit more.
No, no, she said quickly. Please, not now. I don't feel up to it. Let's go. We can come back if we have to.
I studied her face for evidence of her sickness. She looked like an advert for health food. All right, I agreed. There wasn't really much point in another dive, but only I knew that. Let's go home and try and work it out. I stood up and began rewrapping the brass bell.
What are you going to do with that?
She asked anxiously. Redeposit it, I told her. I'm certainly not going to take it back to St. Mary's and display it in the marketplace. Like you said, we can always come back.
Yes, she agreed immediately. Yes, you're right. Yes, of course.
I dropped the package over the side once more and went to haul the hook. On the homeward run, I found Sherry North's presence on the bridge irritated me. There was a lot of hard thinking I had to do. I sent her down to make coffee. Strong, I told her, and with 4 spoonfuls of sugar. It'll be good for your seasickness. She reappeared on the bridge within 2 minutes. The stove won't light, she complained. You have to open the main gas cylinders first, I explained where to find the taps. And don't forget to close them when you finish or you'll turn the boat into a bomb. She made lousy coffee. It was late evening when I picked up moorings in Grand Harbour, and dark by the time I dropped Sherry at the entrance of the hotel. She didn't even invite me in for a drink, but kissed me on the cheek and said, "Darling, let me be alone tonight. I'm exhausted. I'm going to bed now. Let me think about all this, and when I feel better, we can plan more clearly."
"I'll pick you up here. What time?"
"No," she said. "No, I'll meet you at the boat. Early. 8 o'clock? Wait for me there. We can talk in private, just the two of us. No one else, all right?"
"I'll bring Dancer to the wharf at 8, I promised her. It had been a thirsty day, and on the way home I stopped off at the Lord Nelson. Angelo and Judith were with a noisy party of their own age in one of the booths. They called me over and made room for me between two of the girls. I brought them each a pint, and Angelo leaned over confidentially. "Hey, Skipper, are you using the pickup tonight?" "Yes," I said, "to get me home." I knew what was coming, of course. Angelo acted as though he had shares in the vehicle. "There's a big party down at South Point tonight, boss." And suddenly he was very free with the boss and Skipper. "I thought if I run you out to Turtle Bay, then you'd let us have the truck." "I'd pick you up early tomorrow, promise." I took a swallow at my tankard, and they were all watching me with eager, hopeful faces. "It's a big party, Mr. Harry," said Judith. "Please." "Right, you pick me up at 7 o'clock sharp, Angelo, here." And there was a spontaneous burst of relieved laughter. They clubbed together to buy me another pint. I had a disturbed night, with restless sleep interspersed with periods of wakefulness. I had the dream again, when I dived to the canvas package. Once more it contained a tiny Dresden mermaid. But this time she had Sherry North's face, and she offered me the model of a jet fighter aircraft that changed into a golden pumpkin as I reached for it. The pumpkin was etched with the letters VVNL. It rained after midnight, solid sheets of water that poured off the eaves, and the lightning silhouetted the palm fronds against the night sky. It was still raining when I went down to the beach, and the heavy drops exploded in minute bomb bursts of spray upon my naked body. The sea was black in the bad light, and the rain squalls reached to the horizon. I swam alone far out beyond the reef, but when I came back to the beach, the excursion had not provided the usual lift to my spirits. My body was blue and shivering with the cold, and a vague but pervading sense of trouble and depression pressed heavily upon me. I had finished breakfast when the pickup came down the track through the palm plantation, splashing through the puddles and splattered with mud and with headlights still burning. In the yard, Angelo hooted and shouted, "Are you ready, Harry?" And I ran out with a sou'wester held over my head. Angelo smelt of beer, and he was garrulous and slightly bleary of eye. "I'll drive," I told him. And as we crossed the island, he gave me a blow-by-blow description of the great party. From what he told me, it seemed there might be an epidemic of births on St. Mary's in about 9 months' time. I was only half listening to him, for as we approached the town, so my sense of disquiet mounted. "Hey, Harry, the kid said to thank you for the loan of the pickup." "That's okay, Angelo. I sent Judith out to the boat. She's going to tidy up, Harry, and get the coffee going for you." "Oh, she shouldn't have worried," I said. "She wanted to do that, specially. Sort of thank you, you know." "Yeah, she's a good girl." "Sure is, Harry. I love that girl." And Angelo burst into song, "Devil Woman," in the style of Mick Jagger. When we crossed the ridge and started down into the valley, I had a sudden impulse. Instead of continuing straight down Frobisher Street to the harbour, I swung left onto the circular drive above the fort and hospital, and went up the avenue of banyan trees to the Hilton Hotel. I parked the pickup under the canopy and went through to the reception lobby. There was nobody behind the desk this early in the morning, but I leaned across the counter and peered into Marion's cubicle. She was at her switchboard, and when she saw me, her face lit up in a wide grin, and she lifted off her earphones. "Hello, Mr. Harry." "Hello, Marion, love," I returned the grin. "Miss North in her room?" Her expression changed. "Oh, no," she said. "She left over an hour ago." "Left?" I stared at her. "Yes. Went out to the airport with a hotel bus, catching the 7:30 plane." Marion glanced at the cheap Japanese watch on her wrist. "They would have taken off 10 minutes ago." I was taken completely off balance. Of all things, I had least expected this. It didn't make sense for many seconds, and then suddenly and sickeningly it did. "Oh, Jesus Christ," I said. "Judith." And I ran for the pickup. Angela saw my face as I came and sat up straight in the seat and stopped singing. I jumped into the driver's seat and started the engine, thrusting the pedal down hard and swinging in a roaring two-wheel turn. "What is it, Harry?" Angela demanded. "Judith," I said grimly. "You sent her down to the boat."
"When?"
"When I left to fetch you."
"Did she go right away?"
"No, she'd have to bath and dress first." He was telling it straight, not hiding the fact that they'd slept together. He sensed the urgency of the situation. Then she'd have to walk down the valley from the farm. Angelo had lodgings with a peasant family up near the spring. It was a 3-mile walk.
"God, let us be in time," I whispered.
The truck was bellowing down the avenue, and I hit the gears in a racing change as we went out through the gates in a screaming broadside, and I slammed down hard again on the accelerator, pulling her out of the skid by main strength.
"What the hell is wrong, Harry?" he demanded once again. "We've got to stop her going aboard Dancer," I told him, grimly, as we roared down the circular drive above the town.
Past the fort, a vista of Grand Harbour opened beneath us. He didn't waste time with inane questions. We'd worked together too long for that. And if I said so, then he accepted it so. Dancer was still at her moorings, amongst the other island craft, and halfway out to her from the wharf, Judith was rowing the dinghy. Even at this distance, I could make out the tiny feminine figure on the thwart, and recognize the short, business-like oar strokes. She was an island girl, and rowed like a man.
"We aren't going to make it," said Angelo. "She'll get there before we reach Admiralty."
At the top of Frobisher Street, I put the heel of my left hand on the horn ring, and blowing a continuous blast, I tried to clear the road. But it was a Saturday morning, market day, and already the streets were filling. The country folk had come to town in their bullock carts and ancient jalopies. Cursing with a terrible frustration, I hooted and forced my way through them. It took us 3 minutes to cover the half mile from the top of the street down to Admiralty Wharf. "Oh, God," I said,
leaning forward in the seat as I shot through the mesh gates and crossed the railway tracks. The dinghy was tied up alongside Wave Dancer, and Judith was climbing over the side. She wore an emerald green shirt and short denim pants. Her hair was in a long braid down her back. I skidded the truck to a halt beside the pineapple sheds, and both Angelo and I hit the wharf at a run. "Judith!" I yelled, but my voice didn't carry out across the harbour. Without looking back, Judith disappeared into the saloon. Angelo and I raced down to the end of the jetty. Both of us were screaming wildly, but the wind was in our faces and Dancer was 500 yards out across the water. "There's a dinghy," Angelo caught my arm. It was an ancient clinker-built mackerel boat, but it was chained to a ring in the stone wharf. We jumped into it, leaping the 8-foot drop and falling in a heap together over the thwart. I scrambled to the mooring chain. It had quarter-inch galvanized steel links and a heavy brass padlock secured it to a ring. I took two twists of chain around my wrist, braced one foot against the wharf, and heaved. The padlock exploded and I fell backwards into the bottom of the dinghy. Angelo already had the oars in the rowlocks. "Row!" I shouted at him. "Row like a mad bastard!" I was in the bows, cupping my hands to my mouth as I hailed Judith, trying to make my voice carry above the wind. Angelo was rowing in a dedicated frenzy, swinging the oar blades flat and low on the back reach, and then throwing his weight upon them when they bit. His breathing exploded in a harsh grunt at each stroke. Halfway out to Dancer, another rain squall enveloped us, shrouding the whole of Grand Harbour in eddying sheets of grey water. It stung my face, so I had to screw up my eyes. Dancer's outline was blurred by grey rain, but we were coming close now. I was beginning to hope that Judith would sweep and tidy the cabins before she struck a match to the gas ring in the galley. I was also beginning to hope that I was wrong, that Cherry North had not left a farewell present for me. And yet still I could hear my own voice speaking to Cherry North the previous day. "You have to open the main gas cylinders first, and don't forget to close them when you finish, or you'll turn the boat into a bomb." Closer still we came to Dancer, and she seemed to hang on tendrils of rain, ghostly white and insubstantial in the swirling mist. "Judith!" I shouted. She must hear me now. We were so close. There were 2 50-pound cylinders of butane gas on board, enough to destroy a large brick-built house. The gas was heavier than air. Once it escaped, it would slump down, filling Dancer's hull with a murderously explosive mixture of gas and air. It needed just one spark from battery or match. I prayed that I was wrong and yelled again. And then suddenly, Dancer blew. It was flash explosion, a fearsome blue light that shot through her. It split her hull with a mighty hammer stroke and blew her superstructure open, lifting it like a lid. Dancer reared to the mortal blow, and the blast hit us like a storm wind. Immediately, I smelt the electric stench of the blast, acrid as an air-sizzling strike of lightning against ironstone. Dancer died as I watched, a terrible, violent death. And then her torn and lifeless hull fell back, and the cold, grey waters rushed into her. The heavy engines pulled her swiftly down, and she was gone into the grey waters of Grand Harbour. Angelo and I were frozen with horror, crouching in the violently rocking dinghy, staring at the agitated water that was strewn with loose wreckage, all that remained of a beautiful boat and a lovely young girl. I felt a vast desolation descend upon me. I wanted to cry aloud in my anguish, but I was paralyzed. Angelo moved first. He leapt upright with a sound in his throat like a wounded beast. He tried to throw himself over the side, but I caught and held him. "Leave me," he screamed. "Leave me, I must go to her." "No, no." I fought with him in the crazily rocking boat. "It's no good, Angelo." Even if he could get down through the 40 feet of water in which Dancer's torn hull now lay, what he would find might drive him mad. Judith had stood at the center of that blast, and she would have been subjected to all the terrible trauma of massive flash explosion at close range.
Leave me, damn you!
Angelo got one arm free and hit me in the face. But I saw it coming and rolled my head. It grazed the skin from my cheek, and I knew I had to get him quieted down. The dinghy was on the point of capsizing. Though he was 40 pounds lighter than me, Angelo fought with maniac strength. He was calling her name now, Judith, Judith, on a hysterical rising inflection. I released my grip on his shoulder with my right hand and swung him slightly away from me, lining him up carefully. I hit him with a right chop, my fist moving not more than 4 inches. I hit him cleanly on the point below his left ear, and he dropped instantly, gone cold. I lured him to the floorboards and laid him out comfortably. I rode back to the wharf without looking back. I felt completely numbed and drained. I carried Angelo down the wharf, and I hardly felt his weight in my arms. I drove him up to the hospital, and McNabb was on duty. "Give him something to keep him muzzy and in bed for the next 24 hours, I told McNabb, and he began to argue. "Listen, you've broken down old whiskey vat," I told him quietly. "I'd just love an excuse to beat your head in." He paled until the broken veins in his nose and cheeks stood out boldly. "Now listen, Harry, old man," he began. I took one step towards him, and he sent the duty sister to the drug cupboard. I found Chubby at breakfast, and it took only a minute to explain what had happened. We went up to the fort in the pickup, and Wally Andrews responded quickly. He waived the filing of statements and other police procedure, and instead we piled the police diving equipment into the truck, and by the time we reached the harbour, half of St. Mary's had formed a silent, worried crowd along the wharf. Some had seen it, and all of them had heard the explosion. "Somebody find Fred Coker," I told him. "Tell him to get down here with a bag and a basket." And there was a buzz of comment. "Hey, Mr. Harry, was there somebody aboard?" "Just go and get Fred Coker," I told him, and we rowed out to Dancer's moorings. While Wally kept the dinghy on station above us, Chubby and I went down through the murky harbour water. Dancer lay on her back, in 45 feet. She must have rolled as she sank. But there was no need to worry about access to her interior, for her hull had been torn open along the keel. She was far past any hope of refloating. Chubby waited at the hole in the hull while I went in. What remained of the galley was filled with swirling, excited shoals of fish. They were in a feeding frenzy, and I choked and gagged into the mouthpiece of my scuba when I saw what they were feeding upon. The only way I knew it was Judith were the tatters of green cloth clinging to the fragments of flesh. We got her out in 3 main pieces and placed her in the canvas bag that Fred Coker provided. I dived again immediately and worked my way through the shattered hull to the compartment below the galley where the 2 long iron gas cylinders were still bolted to their beds. Both taps were wide open, and somebody had disconnected the hoses to allow the gas to escape freely. I have never experienced anger so intense as I felt then. It was so strong because it fed upon my loss. Dancer was gone, and Dancer had been half my life. I closed the taps and reconnected the gas hose. It was a private thing. I would deal with it personally. When I walked back along the wharf to the pickup, all that gave me comfort was the knowledge that Dancer had been insured. There would be another boat, not as beautiful or as well beloved as Dancer, but a boat nevertheless. In the crowd I noticed the shiny black face of Hambone Williams, the harbour ferryman. For 40 years he had plied his old dinghy back and forth at threepence a hire. "Hambone," I called him over, "did you take anybody out to Dancer last night?"
No, sir, Mr. Harry.
Nobody at all. Only your party. She left her watch in the cabin. I took her out to fetch it.
The lady?
Yes, the lady with the yellow hair.
What time, Hamburn?
About 9 o'clock. Did I do wrong, Mr. Harry?
No, it's all right. Just forget it.
We buried Judith next day before noon. I managed to get the plot beside her mother and father for her. Angelo liked that. He said he didn't want her to be lonely up there on the hill. Angelo was still half-doped, and he was quiet and dreamy-eyed at the graveside. The next morning, the three of us began salvage work on Dancer. We worked hard for 10 days, and we stripped her completely of anything that had a possible value, from the big-game fishing reels and the FN carbine to the twin bronze propellers. The hull and superstructure were so badly broken as to be of no value. At the end of that time, Wave Dancer had become a memory only. I have had many women, and now they are just a pleasant thought when I hear a certain song or smell a particular perfume. Like them, already Dancer was beginning to recede into the past. On the 10th day, I went up to see Fred Coker. And the moment I entered his office, I knew there was something very wrong. He was shiny with nervous sweat. His eyes moved shiftily behind the glittering spectacles, and his hands scampered about like frightened mice, running over his blotter or leaping up to adjust the knot of his necktie or smooth down the thin strands of hair on his polished cranium. He knew I'd come to talk insurance.
"Now, don't get excited, please, Mr. Harry," he advised me. And whenever people tell me that, I become very excited indeed.
"What is it, Coker?"
"Come on, come on!"
And I slammed one fist on the desktop, and he leapt in his chair so the gold-rimmed spectacles slid down his nose.
"Mr. Harry, please! Come on, you miserable little grave worm!"
"Mr. Harry, it's about the premiums on Dancer." I stared at him.
"You see, you'd never made a claim before. It seemed such a waste to..."
I found words.
"You pocketed the premiums," I whispered, my voice failing me suddenly. "You didn't pay them over to the company."
"You understand?" Fred Coker nodded.
I knew you'd understand."
I tried to go over the desk to save time, but I tripped and fell. Fred Coker leapt from his chair, slipping through my outstretched, groping fingers. He ran through the back door, slamming it behind him. I ran straight through the door, tearing off the lock and leaving it hanging on broken hinges. Fred Coker ran as though all the dark angels pursued him, which would have been better for him. I caught him at the big doors into the alley and lifted him up by the throat, holding him with one hand, pressing his back against a pile of cheap pine coffins. He lost his spectacles, and he was weeping with fright, big slow tears welling out of the helpless, short-sighted eyes.
"You know I'm going to kill you," I whispered.
And he moaned, his feet dancing 6 inches above the floor. I pulled back my right fist and braced myself solidly on the balls of my feet. It would have taken his head off. I couldn't do it. But I had to hit something. I drove my fist into the coffin beside his right ear. The panelling shattered, stove in along its full length. Fred Coker shrieked like an hysterical girl at a pop festival, and I let him drop. His legs couldn't hold him, and he sank to the concrete floor. I left him lying there, moaning and blubbering with terror, and I walked out into the street, as near to bankrupt as I'd been in the last 10 years. Mr. Harry, transformed in a single stroke into Fletcher, wharf rat and land-bound bum. It was a classic case of reversion to type. Before I reached the Lord Nelson, I was thinking the same way I had 10 years before. Already I was calculating the percentages, seeking the main chance once more.
Chubby and Angelo were the only customers in the public bar so early in the afternoon. I told them, and they were quiet. There wasn't anything to say. We drank the first one in silence, and then I asked Chubby, "What will you do now?" And he shrugged. "I've still got the old whaleboat." It was a 20-footer, admirable design, open-decked, but sea-kindly. "I'll go for Stump again, I reckon." Stump with a big reef crayfish. There was good money in the frozen tails. It was how Chubby had earned his bread before the dancer and I came to St. Mary's. "You'll need new engines. Those old seagulls of yours are shot." We drank another pint while I worked out my finances. What the hell? A couple of $1,000 wasn't going to make much difference to me. "I'll buy 2 new 20-horse Evinrudes for the boat, Chubby," I volunteered. "Won't let you do it, Harry." He frowned indignantly and shook his head. "I got enough saved up working for you." And he was adamant. "What about you, Angelo?" I asked. "Guess I'll go sell my soul on a Rowano contract." "No." Chubby scowled at the thought. "I'll need crew for the Stump boat." They were all settled then. I was relieved, for I felt responsible for them both. I was particularly glad that Chubby would be there to care for Angelo. The boy had taken Judith's death very badly. He was quiet and withdrawn, no longer the flashing Romeo. I'd kept him working hard on the salvage of Dancer. That alone seemed to have given him the time he needed to recover from the wound. Nevertheless, he began drinking hard now, chasing tots of cheap brandy with pints of bitter. This is the most destroying way to take in alcohol, short of drinking meth, that I know of. Chubby and I took it nice and slow, lingering over our tankards, yet under our jocularity was the knowledge that we'd reached a crossroads, and from tomorrow we would no longer be travelling together. It gave the evening the fine poignancy of impending loss. There was a South African trawler in harbour that night that had come in for bunkers and repairs. When at last Angelo passed out cold, Chubby and I began our singing. Six of the trawler's beefy crew members voiced their disapproval in the most slanderous terms. Chubby and I could not allow insults of that nature to pass unchallenged. We all went out to discuss it in the backyard. "My own flesh and blood," Chubby kept repeating as he and I staggered arm in arm into the cells. He turned on me. "My own sister's son." Wally was human enough to send one of his constables down to the Lord Nelson for something to make our durance less vile. Chubby and I became very friendly with the trawlerman in the next cell, passing the bottle back and forth between the bars. When we were released next morning, Wally Andrews declining to press charges, I drove out to Turtle Bay to begin closing up the shack. I made sure the crockery was clean, threw a few handfuls of mothballs in the cupboards, and didn't bother to lock the doors. There's no such thing as burglary on St. Mary's. For the last time, I swam out beyond the reef, and for half an hour hoped that the dolphins might come. They didn't, and I swam back, showered and changed, picked up my old canvas and leather campaign bag from my bed and went out to where the pickup was parked in the yard. I didn't look back as I drove up through the palm plantation, but I made myself a promise that I'd be coming this way again. I parked in the front lot of the hotel and lit a cheroot. When Marion finished her shift at noon, she came out the front entrance and set off down the drive with her cheeky little bottom swinging under the miniskirt. I whistled and she saw me. She slipped into the passenger seat beside me. "Mr. Harry, I'm so sorry about your boat." We talked for a few minutes, until I could ask the question. "Miss North, while she was staying at the hotel, did she make any telephone calls or send a cable?" "I don't remember, Mr. Harry, but I could check for you." "Now?" "Sure," she agreed. "One other thing. Could you also check with Dickie if he got a shot of her?" Dickie was the roving hotel photographer. It was a good chance that he had a print of Sherry North in his file. Marion was gone for nearly 3/4 of an hour, but she returned with a triumphant smile. She sent a cable on the night before she left. Marion handed me a flimsy copy. "You can keep this copy," she told me as I read the message. It was addressed to Manson, Flat 5, Curzon Street, 97, London West 1. And the message read, "Contract signed, returning Heathrow BOAC Flight 316, Saturday." There was no signature. Dickie had to go through all his files, but he found one. He handed me a 6x4 glossy print. It was of Sherry North reclining on a sun couch on the hotel terrace. She wore her bikini and sunglasses, but it was a good likeness. "Thanks, Marion." And I gave her a £5 note. "Oh, gee, Mr. Harry," she grinned at me as she tucked it into the front of her bra. "For that price, you can take what you fancy." "I've got a plane to catch, love." I kissed her on the little snub nose and slapped her bottom as she climbed out of the cab. Chubby and Angelo came out to the airport. Chubby was to take care of the pickup for me. We were all subdued and shook hands awkwardly at the departure gate. There wasn't much to say. We'd said it all the night before. As the piston-engined aircraft took off for the mainland, I glimpsed the two of them standing together at the perimeter fence. I stopped over 3 hours at Nairobi before catching the BOAC flight on to London. I didn't sleep during the long night flight. It was many years since I'd returned to my native land, and I was coming back now on a grim mission of vengeance. I wanted very much to talk to Sherry North. When your flat broke, that's the time to buy a new car and a 100 guinea suit. Look brave and prosperous, and people will believe you are. I shaved and changed at the airport, and instead of a Hillman, I had hired a Chrysler from the Harts depot at Heathrow, slung my bag in the boot, and drove to the nearest Courage pub. I had a double portion of ham and egg pie washed down with a pint of Courage while I studied the road map. It was all so long ago that I was unsure of my directions. The lush and cultivated English countryside was too tame and green after Malaya and Africa, and the autumn sunshine was pale gold, whereas I was used to a brighter, fiercer sun. But it was a pleasant drive over the downs and into Brighton. I parked the Chrysler on the promenade opposite the Grand Hotel and dived into the warren of the lanes. They were filled with tourists even as late as this in the season. Pavilion Arcade was the address I'd read so long ago on Jimmy North's underwater sledge, and it took me nearly an hour to find it. It was tucked away at the back of a cobbled yard, and most of the windows and doors were shuttered and closed. North's Underwater World had a 10-foot frontage onto the lane. That also was closed, and a blind was drawn across the single window. I tried without success to peer round the edge of the blind, but the interior was darkened. I hammered on the door. There was no sound from within, and I was about to turn away when I noticed a square piece of cardboard that had once been stuck onto the bottom of the window, but had fallen to the floor inside. By twisting my head acrobatically, I could read the handwritten message, which had fortunately fallen face up. "Enquiries to Sea View, Downers Lane, Falmer, Sussex." I went back to the car and took the road map out of the glove compartment. It began to rain as I pushed the Chrysler through narrow lanes. The windscreen wipers flogged sullenly at the spattering drops, and I peered into the premature gloom of early evening. Twice I lost my way, but finally I pulled up outside a gate in a thick hedge. The sign nailed to the gate read, "North Sea View," and I believed that it might be possible to look southwards on a clear day and see the Atlantic. I drove down between hedges and came into the paved yard of an old double-storied red-brick farmhouse with oak beams set into the walls and green moss growing on the wood-shingle roof. There was a light burning downstairs. I parked the Chrysler and crossed the yard to the kitchen door, turning up my collar against the wind and rain. I beat on the door and heard somebody moving around inside. The bolts were shot back, and the top half of the stable door opened on a chain. A girl looked out at me. I wasn't immediately impressed by her, for she wore a baggy blue fisherman's jersey, and she was a tall girl with a swimmer's shoulders. I thought her plain, in a striking manner. Her brow was pale and broad, her nose was large but not bony or beaked, and below it her mouth was wide and friendly. She wore no makeup at all, so her lips were pale pink, and there was a peppering of fine freckles on her nose and cheeks. Her hair was drawn back severely from her face into a thick braid behind her neck. Her hair was black, shimmering iridescent black in the lamplight, and her eyebrows were black also, black and boldly arched over eyes that seemed also to be black until the light caught them, and I realized they were the same dark, haunted blue as the Mozambique current when the noon sun strikes directly into it. Despite the pallor of her skin, there was an aura of good and glowing health about her. The pale skin had a luster and plasticity to it, a quality that was somehow luminous, so that when you studied her closely, as I was now doing, it seemed that you could see down through the surface to the flush of clean blood rising warmly to her cheeks and neck. She touched the tendril of silky dark hair that escaped the braid and floated lightly on her temple. It was an appealing gesture that betrayed her nervousness and belied the serene expression in the dark blue eyes. Suddenly I realized that she was an unusually handsome woman, for although she was only in her mid-twenties, I knew she was no longer girl, but full woman. There was a strength and maturity about her, a deep sense of calm that I found intriguing. Usually the women I choose are more obvious. I don't like to tie up too much of my energy in the pursuit. This was something beyond my experience, and for the first time in years I felt unsure of myself. We'd been staring at each other for many seconds, neither of us speaking or moving. "You are Harry Fletcher," she said at last, and her voice was low and gently modulated, a cultivated and educated voice. I gaped at her. "How the hell did you know that?" I demanded. "Come in." She slipped the chain and opened the bottom of the stable door, and I obeyed. The kitchen was warm and welcoming, and filled with the smell of good food cooking. "How did you know my name?" I asked again. "Your picture was in the newspaper with Jimmy's," she explained. We were silent again, once more studying each other. She was taller even than I'd thought at first, reaching to my shoulder, with long legs clad in dark blue pants and the tops thrust into black leather boots. Now I could see the narrow waist and the promise of good breasts beneath the thick jersey. At first I had thought her plain. 10 seconds later I had reckoned her handsome. And now I doubted I had ever seen a more beautiful woman. It took time for the full effect to sink in. "You have me at a disadvantage," I said at last. "I don't know your name." "I'm Sherry North," she answered. And I stared at her for a moment before I recovered from the shock. She was a very different person from the other Sherry North I had known. "Did you know that there's a whole tribe of you?" I asked her at last. I don't understand." She frowned at me. Her eyes were enchantingly blue under the lowered brows.
"Well, it's a long story."
"I'm sorry." For the first time, she seemed to become aware that we were standing facing each other in the centre of the kitchen. "Won't you sit down? Can I get you a beer?" Sherry took a couple of cans of Carlsberg lager from the cupboard and sat opposite me across the kitchen table. "You were going to tell me a long story." She popped the tabs on the cans and slid one across to me, looked at me expectantly. I began to tell her the carefully edited version of my experiences since Jimmy North arrived at St. Mary's. She was very easy to talk to,
like being with an old and interested friend. Suddenly I wanted to tell her everything, the entire unblemished truth. It was important that from the very beginning it should be right, with no reservations. She was a complete stranger, and yet I was placing trust in her beyond any person I'd ever known. I told her everything exactly as it had happened. She fed me after dark had fallen, a savory casserole out of an earthenware pot, which we ate with homemade bread and farm butter. I was still talking, but no longer about the recent events on St. Mary's, and she listened quietly. At last, I had found another human being with whom I could talk without reserve. I went back in my life. In a complete catharsis, I told her of the early days, even of the dubious manner in which I'd earned the money to buy Wave Dancer, and how my good resolutions since then had wavered. It was after midnight when at last she said, "I can hardly believe all you've told me. You don't look like that. You look so..." And she seemed to search for the word. "You look so wholesome." But you could see it wasn't the word she wanted. "Oh, I work hard at being that. But sometimes my halo falls over me eyes. You see, appearances are deceptive," I said, and she nodded. "Yes, yes, there are." And there was a significance in the way she said it. A warning, perhaps. "Why have you told me all this? It isn't really very wise, you know."
"It was just time that somebody knew about me, I suppose. I'm sorry you were elected."
She smiled. "You can sleep in Jimmy's room tonight," she said. "I can't risk you rushing out and telling anybody else." I hadn't slept the night before, and suddenly I was exhausted. I felt as though I didn't have the strength to climb the stairs to the bedroom. But I had one question still to ask. "Why did Jimmy come to St. Mary's? What was he looking for?" I asked. "Do you know who he was working with? Who they were?" "I don't know." She shook her head, and I knew it was the truth. She wouldn't lie to me now, after I had placed such trust in her. "Will you help me find out? Will you help me to find them?" "Yes," she said. "Yes, I'll help you," and stood up from the table. "We'll talk again in the morning." Jimmy's room was under the eaves, the pitch of the roof giving it an irregular shape. The walls were lined with photographs and packed bookshelves, silver sporting trophies, and the treasured bric-a-brac of boyhood. The bed was high and the mattress soft. I went to fetch my bag from the Chrysler while Sherry put clean sheets on the bed. Then she showed me the bathroom and left me. I lay and listened to the rain on the roof for only a few minutes before I slept. I woke in the night and heard the soft whisper of a voice somewhere in the quiet house. Barefooted and in my underpants, I opened the bedroom door and crept silently down the passage to the stairs. I looked down into the hall. There was a light burning, and Sherry North stood at the wall telephone. She was speaking so quietly into the receiver, cupping her hands to her mouth, that I couldn't catch the words. The light was behind her. She wore a flimsy nightdress, and her body showed through the thin stuff as though she were naked. I found myself staring like a peeping Tom. The lamplight glowed on the ivory sheen of her skin, and there were intriguing secret hollows and shadows beneath the transparent cloth. With an effort, I pulled my eyes off her and went back to my bed. I thought about Sherry's telephone call and felt a vague disquiet. But soon sleep overtook me once more. In the morning, the rain had stopped, but the ground was slushy and the grass heavy and wet when I went out for a breath of cold morning air. I expected to feel awkward with Sherry after the previous night's outpourings of the soul, but it was not so. We talked easily at breakfast, and afterwards she said, "I promised I'd help you. What can I do?"
"Answer a few questions."
"All right. Ask me."
Jimmy North had been very secretive. She didn't know he was going to St. Mary's. He had told her he had a contract to install some electronic underwater equipment at the Cuporabasa Dam in Portuguese Mozambique. She had taken him up to the airport with all his equipment. As far as she knew, he was travelling alone. The police had come to the shop in Brighton to tell her of his murder. She had read the newspaper reports, and that was all. No letters from Jimmy.
No, nothing.
I nodded. The Wolf Pack must have intercepted his mail. The letter I'd been shown by Sherry's impostor was certainly genuine.
I don't understand anything about this. Am I being stupid?
No. I took out a cheroot and almost lit it before I stopped myself. All right if I smoke one of these? It doesn't bother me, she said, and I was glad, for it would have been hell giving them up. I lit it and drew in the fragrant smoke. It looks as though Jimmy stumbled on something big. He needed backing and he went to the wrong people. As soon as they thought they knew where it was, they killed him and tried to kill me. When that didn't work, they sent out someone impersonating you. When she thought she knew the location of this object, she set a trap for me and went home. Their next move will be a return to the area of Big Gull Island, where they're due for another disappointment. She refilled the coffee cups, and I noticed that she'd applied makeup this morning, but very lightly, so that the freckles still showed. I reconsidered the previous night's judgment and confirmed that she was one of the most beautiful women I'd ever met, even in the early morning. She was frowning thoughtfully, staring into her coffee cup, and I wanted to touch one of her slim, strong-looking hands that lay on the tablecloth near my own. "What were they after, Harry? And who are those people who killed him?" she asked at last. "Two excellent questions. I have leads to both. But we'll tackle the questions in the order you asked them. Firstly, what was Jimmy after? And when we know that, we can go after his murderers." "I have no idea at all what it could be." She looked up at me. The blue of her eyes was lighter than it had been last night. It was the colour of a good sapphire. "What clues have you got?"
"The ship's bell. The design upon it."
"What does that signify?" "I don't know, but it shouldn't be too hard to find out." I could no longer resist the temptation. I placed my hand over hers. It felt as firm and strong as it looked, and her flesh was warm. "But first I should like to check the shop in Brighton, and Jimmy's room there. There might be something we can use." She'd not withdrawn her hand. "All right, shall we go to the shop first? The police have already been through it all, but they might have overlooked something."
"Fine. I'll buy you lunch."
I squeezed her hand and she turned it in my grasp and squeezed back.
"I'll take you up on that," she said.
And I was too astonished by my own reaction to her grip to find a light reply. My throat was dry and my pulse beat as though I'd run a mile. Gently she removed her hand and stood up.
"Well, let's do the breakfast dishes."
If the girls of St. Mary's could only have seen Mr. Harry drying dishes, my reputation would have been shattered into 1,000 pieces. She led us into the shop the back way, through a tiny enclosed yard which was almost filled with unusual objects, all of them associated with diving and the underwater world. Discarded air bottles and a portable compressor, brass portals and other salvage from wrecked ships, and even the jawbone of a killer whale, with all its teeth intact. "I haven't been in for a very long time," Sherry apologized as she unlocked the back door of the shop. "Without Jimmy..." She shrugged and then went on. "I really must get down to selling up all this junk and closing the shop down. I could resell the lease, I suppose."
"Well, I'm going to look round, all right?"
"Fine. I'll get the kettle going."
I started in the yard, searching quickly but thoroughly through the piles of junk. There was nothing that had significance as far as I could see. I went into the shop and poked around among the seashells and shark's teeth on the shelves and in the display case. Finally, I saw a desk in the corner and began going through the drawers. Sherry brought me a cup of tea and perched on the corner of the desk, while I piled old invoices, rubber bands and paper clips on the top. I read every scrap of paper and even rifled through the ready reckoner. Nothing? Sherry asked. Nothing, I agreed, and glanced at my watch. Lunchtime, I told her. She locked up the shop, and by good fortune we stumbled on English's restaurant. They gave us a secluded table in the back room, and I ordered a bottle of Puy Fuissé to go with the lobster. Once I recovered from the shock of the price, we laughed a lot during the meal, and it wasn't just the wine. The feeling between us was good and growing stronger. After lunch, we drove back to Seaview, and we went up to Jimmy's room. This is our best bet, I guessed. If he was keeping secrets, this is where they'd be. But I knew I had a long job ahead of me. There were hundreds of books and piles of magazines, mostly American, Argosy, Trident, The Diver, and so on, and other diving publications. There was also a complete shelf of Springback files at the foot of the bed. Well, I'll leave you to it, Sherry said, and went. I took down the contents of a shelf, sat at the reading table, and began to skim through the publications. Immediately, I saw it was an even bigger task than I'd thought. Jimmy had been one of those people who read with a pencil in one hand. There were notes penciled in the margin, comments, queries, and exclamation marks, and anything that interested him was underlined. I read on doggedly, looking for something that could remotely be linked to St. Mary's. Around 8 o'clock, I began on the shelf that held the Springback files. The first two were filled with newspaper clippings on shipwrecks or other marine phenomena. The third of them had an unlabeled black imitation leather cover. It held a thin sheath of papers, and I saw immediately that they were out of the ordinary. There were a series of letters, filed with their envelopes and stamps still attached. There were 16 of them in all, addressed to Messrs. Parker and Wilton in Fenchurch Street. Every letter was in a different hand, but all were executed in the elegant penmanship of the last century. The envelopes were sent from different parts of the old empire, Canada, South Africa, India. And in the 19th century, postage stamps alone must have been of considerable value. After I'd read the first two letters, it was clear that Messrs. Parker and Wilton were agents and factors, and they had acted for a number of distinguished clients in the service of Queen Victoria. The letters were instructions to deal with estates, monies, and securities. All the letters were dated during the period from August 1857 to July 1858, and must have been offered by a dealer or an antique auctioneer as a lot. I glanced through them quickly, but the contents were really very dull. However, something on the single page of the 10th letter caught my eye, and I felt my nerves jump. Two words had been underlined in pencil, and in the margin was a notation in Jimmy North's handwriting. Bemis, E61914, 8 in brackets. However, it was the words themselves that held me. Dawn light. I'd heard those words before. I wasn't sure where, but they were significant. Quickly, I began at the top of the page. The sender's address was a laconic Bombay, and it was dated the 16th of September, 1857. My dear Wilton, I charge you most strictly with the proper care and safe storage of 5 pieces of luggage consigned in my name to your London address aboard the Honourable Company's ship Dawn Light. Due out of this port before the 25th instant and bound for the Company's wharf in the Port of London. Please acknowledge safe receipt of same with all dispatch. I remain yours faithfully, Colonel Sir Roger Goodchild, Officer commanding the 101st Regiment Queen's Own India Rifles. Deliver by kind favour of Captain commanding Her Majesty's frigate Panther. The paper rustled, and I realised that my hand was shaking with excitement. I knew I was on to it now. This was the key. I laid the letter carefully on the reading table and placed a silver paper knife upon it to weigh it down. I began to read it again slowly, but there was a distraction. I heard the engine noise of an automobile coming down the lane from the gate. Headlights flashed across the window and then rounded the corner of the house. I sat up straight, listening. The engine noise died, and car doors slammed shut. There was a long silence then, before I heard the murmur and growl of voices, men's voices. I began to stand up from the table. And then Sherry screamed. It rang clearly through the old house and cut into my brain like a lance. It aroused in me a protective instinct so fierce that I was down the stairs and into the hall before I'd realized I'd even moved. The door to the kitchen was open and I pushed in the doorway. There were two men with Sherry. The heavier and elder of the two wore a beige camel hair topcoat and a tweed cap. He had a greyish, heavy-lined face and deep-sunk eyes. His lips were thin and colourless. He had Sherry's left hand twisted up between her shoulder blades and was holding her jammed against the wall beside the gas stove. The other man was younger, and he was slim and pale, bareheaded with long, straw-yellow hair falling to the shoulders of his leather jacket. He was grinning gleefully as he held Sherry's other hand over the blue flame of the gas ring, bringing it down slowly. She was struggling desperately, but they held her, and her hair had come loose as she fought.
"Slowly, lad," the man in the cap spoke in a thick, strangled voice. "Give her time to think about it."
Sherry screamed again, as her fingers were forced down remorselessly towards the hissing blue flames. "Go ahead, love. Shout your head off," laughed the blonde. "There isn't nobody to hear you." "Only me," I said. And they spun to face me with expressions of comical amazement.
"Who?"
asked the blonde, releasing Sherry's arm and reaching quickly for his back pocket. I hit him twice, left in the body and right in the head. And although neither shot pleased me particularly, there wasn't the right solidness at impact. The man went down, falling heavily over a chair and crashing into the cupboard. I had no more time for him, and I went for the one in the cloth cap. He was still holding Sherry in front of him, and as I started forward, he hurled her at me. It took me off balance, and I was forced to grab her to save both of us from falling. The man turned and darted out of the door behind him. It took me a few seconds to disentangle myself from Sherry and cross the kitchen. As I barged out into the yard, he was halfway to an elderly Triumph sports car, and he glanced over his shoulder. I could almost see him make the calculation. He wasn't going to be able to get into the car and turn it to face the lane before I caught him. He swerved to the left and sprinted into the dark mouth of the lane, with the skirts of the camel hair coat billowing behind him. I raced after him. The surface was greasy with wet clay, and he was making heavy going on it. He slid and almost fell, and I was right behind him, coming up swiftly, when he turned and I heard the snap of the knife and saw the flash of the blade as it jumped out. He dropped into a crouch with the knife extended, and I ran straight in without a check. He didn't expect that. The glint of steel will stop most men dead. He went for my belly, a long underhand stroke, but he was shaky and breathless, and it lacked fire. I blocked on the wrist and at the same time hit the pressure point in his forearm. The knife dropped out of his hand and I threw him over my hip. He fell heavily on his back and although the mud softened the impact, I dropped on one knee into his belly. It had 210 pounds of body weight behind it and it drove the air out of his lungs in a loud whoosh. He doubled up like a fetus in the womb, wheezing for breath, and I flipped him over onto his face. The cloth cap fell off his head, and I found that he had a thick shock of dark hair shot through with strands of silver. I took a good handful of it, sat on his shoulders, and pushed his face deep into the yellow mud. "I don't like little boys who bully girls," I told him conversationally, and behind me the engine of the Triumph roared into life. The headlights blazed out and then swung in a wide arc until they burnt directly up the narrow lane. I knew I hadn't taken the blonde out properly, It had been a hurried botchy job. I left the man in the mud and ran back down the lane. The wheels of the Triumph spun on the paving of the barnyard, and with its headlights blazing dazzlingly into my eyes, it jumped forward, slewing and skidding, as it left the paving and entered the muddy lane. The driver met the skid and came straight at me. I fell flat and rolled into the cold ooze of a narrow open drain that carried runoff water through the tall hedge. The Triumph hit the side a glancing blow, and the hedge pushed it slightly off its line. The near side wheels spun viciously on the edge of the stone coping of the drain, inches from my face, and mud and a shower of twigs fell on me. And then it was past. It checked as it came level with the man in the muddy camel hair coat. He was kneeling on the verge of the road, and now he dragged himself into the passenger seat of the Triumph. Just as I crawled out of the drain and ran up behind the sports car, it pulled away again, mud spraying from the spinning rear wheels. In vain, I raced after it, but it gathered speed and tore away up the slope. I gave up, turned and ran back down the lane, groping for the keys of the Chrysler in my sodden trousers pocket, and realized I'd left them on the table in Jimmy's room. Sherry was leaning in the open doorway of the kitchen. She held her burnt hand to her chest, and her hair was in tangled disarray. The sleeve of her jersey was torn loose from the shoulder. "I couldn't stop him, Harry," she gasped. "I did try." "How bad is it?" I asked her, abandoning all thoughts of chasing the sports car when I saw her distress. "Slightly singed." "I'll take you to a doctor." "No, no, it doesn't need it." But her smile was lopsided with pain. I went up to Jimmy's room, and from my travelling medicine kit I took a doloxine for the pain and a Mogadon to let her sleep. "I don't need it," she protested. "Do I have to hold your nose and force them down?" I asked, and she grinned, shook her head and swallowed them. "You'd better take a bath," she said. "You're soaked." And suddenly I realized I was sodden and cold. When I came back to the kitchen, glowing from the bath, she was already woozy with the pills, but she'd made coffee for us and strengthened it with a tot of whiskey. We drank it, sitting opposite each other. "What did they want?" I asked. "What did they say?" "They thought I knew why Jimmy had gone to St. Mary's. They wanted to know." I thought about that. Something didn't make sense. It worried me. "I think..." Sherry's voice was unsteady, and she staggered slightly as she tried to stand. "Wow! What did you give me?" I picked her up, and she protested weakly, but I carried her up to her room. It was chintzy and girlish, with rose-patterned wallpaper. I laid her on the bed, pulled off her shoes, and covered her with a quilt. She sighed and closed her eyes. "I think I'll keep you around," she said. "You're very useful." Thus encouraged, I sat on the edge of the bed and gentled her to sleep, smoothing her hair off her temples and stroking the broad forehead. Her skin felt like warm velvet. She was asleep within a minute. I switched off the light and was about to leave when I thought better of it. I slipped off my own shoes and crept in under the quilt. In her sleep, she rolled quite naturally into my arms, and I held her close. It was a good feeling, and soon I slept also. I woke in the dawn. Her face was pressed into my neck, one leg and arm were thrown over me, and her hair was soft and tickling my cheek. Without waking her, I gently disengaged myself, kissed her forehead, picked up my shoes, and went back to my own room. It was the first time I had spent an entire night with a beautiful woman in my arms, and done nothing but sleep. I felt puffed up with virtue. The letter lay upon the reading table in Jimmy's room, where I'd left it, and I read it through again before I went to the bathroom. The penciled note in the margin, B. Muss, E. 6914, bracket 8, puzzled me, and I fretted over it while I shaved. The rain had stopped and the clouds were breaking up, and I went down into the yard to examine the scene of the previous night's encounter. The knife lay in the mud, and I picked it up and tossed it over the hedge. I went into the kitchen, stamping my feet and rubbing my hands in the cold. Sherry had started breakfast. "How's the hand?" "Sore," she admitted. "We'll find a doctor on the way up to London." "What makes you think I'm going to London?" she asked carefully as she buttered toast. 2 things. You can't stay here. The wolf pack'll be back. She looked up at me quickly, but was silent. The other thing is that you promised to help me, and the trail leads to London. She was unconvinced, so while we ate, I showed her the letter I'd found in Jimmy's file. I don't see the connection, she said at last, and I admit it frankly, it's not clear to me even. I lit my first cheroot of the day as I spoke, and the effect was almost magical. But as soon as I saw the words, Dawn Light, something went click. I stopped.